This is an open meeting of the Atlantic Group of Alcoholics Anonymous, and all are welcome to attend. It is our belief that our meeting structure is necessary to maintain the integrity of the group so it may better carry the message of AA. And since the most important aspect of AA recovery is one alcoholic relating to another, only alcoholics participate. If your primary problem is other than alcoholism, we think it would also be helpful for you to contact an anonymous organization which more specifically deals with your addiction. Our literature persons, Phil and Dino, have the list of such groups with their phone numbers. In any case, we hope that what you learn here may be helpful to your recovery and or understanding. Rick will read the preamble.
Hi, my name is Rick. I'm an alcoholic.
Hi.
Alcoholics Anonymous is a fellowship of men and women who share their experience, strength, and hope with each other that they may solve their common problem and help others to recover from alcoholism. The only requirement for membership is a desire to stop drinking. There are no dues or fees for AA membership. We are self-supporting through our own contributions. AA is not allied with any sect, denomination, politics, organization, or institution, does not wish to engage in any controversy, neither endorses nor opposes any causes. Our primary purpose is to stay sober and help other alcoholics to achieve sobriety.
Please join me in the Serenity Prayer. God,
grant me the serenity to accept the things that I cannot change, the courage to dream to things I can, and the wisdom to know the difference.
Whitney will read the steps.
Hi, I'm Whitney. I'm an alcoholic. Step one, we admitted we were powerless over alcohol, that our lives had become unmanageable. Step two, came to believe that a power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity. Step three, made a decision to turn our will and our lives over to the care of God as we understood him. Step four, made a searching and fearless moral inventory of ourselves. Step five, admitted to God, to ourselves, and to another human being the exact nature of our wrongs. Step six, we're entirely ready to have God remove all these defects of character. Step seven, humbly asked him to remove our shortcomings. Step eight, made a list of all persons we had harmed and became willing to make amends to them all. Step nine, made direct amends to such people wherever possible, except when to do so would injure them or others. Step 10, continued to take personal inventory, and when we were wrong, promptly admitted it. Step 11, sought through prayer and meditation to improve our conscious contact with God as we understood him, praying only for the knowledge of his will for us and the power to carry that out. Step 12, having had a spiritual awakening as a result of these steps, we tried to carry this message to alcoholics and to practice these principles in all our affairs.
Rose will read the traditions.
Hi, I'm Rose. I'm an alcoholic. Okay. The 12 traditions. One, our common welfare should come first. Personal recovery depends upon AA unity. Two, for our group purpose, there is but one ultimate authority, a loving God, as he may express himself in our group conscience. Our leaders are but trusted servants. They do not govern. Three, the only requirement from the AA membership is a desire to stop drinking. Four, each group should be autonomous, except in matters affecting other groups or AA as a whole. Five, each group has one primary purpose, to carry its message to the alcoholic who still suffers. Six, an AA group ought never endorse, finance, or lend the AA name to any related facility or outside enterprise, lest problems of money, property, and prestige divert us from our primary purpose. Seven, every AA group ought to be fully self-supporting, declining outside contributions. Eight, Alcoholics Anonymous should remain forever non-professional, but our service centers may employ special workers. Nine, AA as such ought never be organized, but we may create service boards or committees directly responsible to those they serve. 10. Alcoholics Anonymous has no opinion on outside issues, hence the AA name ought never be joined as a public controversy. 11, our public relations policy is based on attraction rather than promotion. We need always maintain personal anonymity at the level of press, radio, and films. 12, anonymity is the spiritual foundation of all traditions, ever reminding us to place principles before personalities.
The format of this meeting is 2 10-minute speakers followed by our information break, and then our main speaker who will speak for 30 minutes. Our first 10-minute speaker is Roy.
Hi, my name is Roy, and I'm an alcoholic. This is the first meeting I ever came to. I got sober at AG. Pierre is my sponsor. I'm working step 9, practicing 10, 11, and 12. I have almost 15 months of sobriety. I used to sit out there as a newcomer and just, you know, think about, like, what I would say if I ever got up here. And I would, you know, I would lose sleep over it. This is the first meeting I came to. I remember walking through the greeters line and just kind of being freaked out by, you know, everyone was like, hello. And then I came into this room, and I just remember, like, the positive energy in this room. I just, like, that's one thing that I'll never forget. And I remember, you know, and I got some people's phone numbers, and somebody bought me a book, Living Sober. And I'm sitting up here, like, in the first few rows, and I remember, and I think it was Matt and Barry who carried the message to me that night. And I'm just listening to their story, and I just I was relating to their story. I just couldn't believe that they had even suffered the way I was suffering that night, because they just looked so good up here. And, you know, because I was in a lot of pain when I came in here. I mean, I just couldn't, I just couldn't function. I couldn't, like, ride the subway. I couldn't, you know, people's behavior just baffled me. I didn't understand, like, why you said the things you said, why you acted the way you acted. You know, if there were, like, 30 days in the month, like, 30 of those days would be just awful. And, you know, those numbers are a lot better right now. So I'm sitting in here, and I'm, you know, I keep coming to, you know, I came back to the meeting the following week, and I heard about alcoholism and, you know, the spiritual malady and the illness of the mind. And it was a relief to finally know what was wrong with me, because, like, forever I thought that I had, like, a brain tumor or cancer. And, you know, that right there and then, I just knew that I needed a relationship with my higher, with God, with the universe. Like, I needed to plug in, because I was just like a lost child. I was, like, blowing in the wind, and I was basically just lost. And, you know, I started drinking when I was 15. Then high school was a lot of fun. It was new. It was fresh. It was exciting. You know, college, things got a little bit worse. I started to get the blackouts. I started to have really bad hangovers. And I figured out that if I threw up the night before, like, I wouldn't wake up with such a bad hangover. And, you know, I was doing this so often, my roommates, they thought that I had an eating disorder. So, you know, I'm trying to explain to them that, you know, I'm just trying to get the alcohol out. And they pretty much thought I was nuts. And, you know, after college, I mean, you know, when I, in after college, things got, they got worse. I mean, I got involved with, like, all the other stuff, and I, you know, 2007 was a really bad year for me. I mean, my life was just crumbling around me in 2007, and, you know, I couldn't go to work. I was calling in sick every other week. I was showing up to work on no sleep. And I was sleeping, you know, at my desk. And, you know, I was informed that that wasn't a good idea. So I started sleeping in the bathroom stall. And, you know, just one day I just went to HR and I was just like, listen, this, you know, I need some, I think I'm going to take some time off to get some help. And then, you know, they just really wanted me out the door. So they offered me a really, like, generous, you know, severance package. So, you know, in my head, I was just like, you know, you mean I don't have to go to work anymore? And, you know, where do I sign? So, you know, you know, after that, you know, I'm not working. I'm still making money. Things are, you know, I was seeing a psychiatrist at the time. I was on a bunch of medication for like general depression, anxiety. I just wanted to touch on that real quick because, you know, AA has no opinion on any of that stuff, but this is just my experience. I mean, I was on a lot of medication for a long time, and it wasn't until I came off the medication that I was able to see what I needed to see in order to surrender, because what it was doing for me was enabling me and allowing me to continue doing what I was doing and thinking that everything was okay. And it was sugarcoating all my problems, and you know, I haven't been on anything in over 15 months, and you know, it's just great to like feel alive. And you know, after that, you know, my psychiatrist suggested that I go to AA. I said that's out of the question. I started going to an outpatient. You know, at the outpatient, I met somebody who comes to this meeting, and he eventually convinced me to come to this meeting. So I came here, and I got a sponsor, and, you know, my sponsor was telling me what to do, and I was telling him what I was going to do. And, you know, eventually, you know, I ended up at a rehab, and, you know, after the rehab, you know, they told me that I was going to use again, and that's what happened. Because they suggested that I go to a halfway house or a sober house, and I didn't do that. So I came back to New York, you know, from the rehab, and I just, you know, I put myself in the hospital. January 22nd, 2007, I'm laying in bed, I'm watching TV, and it says, breaking news, Heath Ledger dead. Like right there and then, I just knew that I didn't want to die, and that's where I surrendered, and I knew I didn't have the answer, and I just, you know, cashed in all my chips, and I said, game over. And at that point, I shut my mouth, I put my head down, and I did whatever my sponsor told me to do. I started calling my sponsor every day. I started going to meetings every day. I come early, I leave late, I go to fellowship, I call other alcoholics, I have service commitments, I mean, that's how I get sober. I just do whatever my sponsor tells me to do. We went through the steps, and, you know, we read through them line by line from page one. And I started praying a lot. I prayed and prayed and prayed as if my life depended on it, like as if it was going to be the last thing I ever did. And I just, you know, it took me a long time. It took me like 9 months. And then one day I was laying in bed. This was November 10th, and you know, I was reading a book, which was rare, but like out of nowhere, I had this overwhelming feeling that God was with me. And, you know, that he had always been with me, but that I had just never acknowledged him. And I'll, you know, never forget that day. I mean, I was on fire, electrified for like the next 2 days. And, you know, that's what I work on now, that conscious contact with God. And I can, that's... You know, like today, you know, I pray, I get down on my knees, I ask God to remove my defects of character so that I can be of service to him. And I can literally, like, go into that God zone. And it's the fourth dimension, which they talk about in the book. And, you know, it's, I was never able to do that before. Like I said, I was lost. I was in a lot of pain. And, you know, my life has gotten a lot better. I mean, I remember coming in, I would look at the 9-step promises and just thinking like how great that would be if those promises came true. And, you know, right now at this point, I don't even think about the promises. It's just like, if you have God in your life, that's all you need. I mean, if whether or not like each individual one is true at the moment, it doesn't really matter because you have God in your life and like everything is good. You know, if you're new, you know, keep coming back, come to meetings, go out to fellowship, get a sponsor. It doesn't matter who it is, because like we're all here to help you. That's what I did. People will start to see your face. You'll, you know, become, you know, feel like you're part of the crew here. And you know, this isn't easy. Getting sober is very hard. And you know, you're going to feel feelings and emotions and fears that you've never felt before. And For me, that's a blessing to be able to do that now because, you know, before I was just drinking to feel nothing. And I'd like to thank Jero for asking me to speak. This is my home group. I love my home group, and thank you.
Our second 10-minute speaker is Pam.
Hi, I'm Pam. I'm an alcoholic. So I'll start with the basics. My home group is the Atlantic Group. My sobriety date is March 27, 2008. I'm currently working on steps 9 and 10, and my sponsor is Amy M. You know, this is just such a gift to be standing up here. I'm nervous, but I feel so blessed because every morning I get on my knees and I ask God to help me be of service to other alcoholics. And look at the gift that he's given me, like just to be standing up here. So I'll start off with my childhood, I guess. I grew up in a small town in Long Island, and we were one of the only very few Indian families that lived in the neighborhood. So I remember as early on as I can that I always felt a little bit different. My mother kind of dressed us a little bit differently, and we celebrated different holidays than other people. And I really escaped at that time by fantasies and reading. So I would go to school and come home and read like a book every day. And by the time I was in first grade, I was reading like seventh grade level books because it was just my like fantasy, like my escape, you know, like that someone was going to come and whisk me away and take me out of this life that I was living in. And my father is and was at that time too an active alcoholic. So I knew early on that alcohol was bad and that I didn't, I knew that the destruction that it caused my family, the shame, the embarrassment, the pain that it caused my my parents' relationship. And so I swore to myself that I would never drink until I did. And then, you know, until I turned 21. And, you know, living up until that point, I really never developed a very strong sense of self. So I spent my years just kind of being who you wanted me to be and kind of just going with the flow that way. So if you said one thing, then that's who I was. And if you said something else, then that's what I was too. So, you know, I turned 21 and everyone's like, you have to drink on your 21st birthday. And I was like, okay. So, you know, I went out and that was like the first time that I really drank. And, you know, I was powerless from the beginning. I don't even remember getting home that night. I know that I passed out. But the things that I do remember of that night was that people told me that they liked me when I was drunk, that I was a lot more fun, that I was less uptight, and that I was funny. And so I felt like, wow, like this was it. I had arrived. And then, you know, that was it. And it progressively, that was the beginning. And 11 years later, when I was 32, it kind of started to end with the boyfriend that I was living with at the time walked in and found me passed out on the floor of our apartment with the door open. And he thought somebody had come in and attacked me and, you know, hurt me. So he ran in, turned on the lights, turned me over, and saw a bottle roll away from me. And I was all cut and banged up, and I don't remember anything, you know, from that night, except that I was upset for some silly reason and decided that I, you know, needed to drink over it as you know, every other day. And, you know, he wanted to break up with me, and I was a typical alcoholic and manipulated myself into staying in that relationship by promising that I was never going to drink again, and that was it, and that I just was, you know, going to be the sober, amazing girlfriend that I always swore that I was going to be, that I just could never be that night. You know, I'd wake up in the morning and say I was going to be this one way. And so I was hiding my alcohol, and I was hiding my bottles in my hamper and in my dresser drawers and anywhere that I could think. You know, I was putting it in wine in teacups and pretending that it was tea. And I felt so, like, demoralized, you know. I just lay on the couch. I was scared to go to work. I would hear people outside living life, you know, whether it was screaming, laughing, just living. And I didn't know how to do that. I didn't know what was wrong with me that I just couldn't participate in this thing called life, you know, that everyone else seemed to be able to do. And, you know, I decided that the problem wasn't me and that I needed to go to couples counseling with my boyfriend. So I made an appointment to go to a therapist, and he said, well, the boyfriend decided he wasn't going to go because he didn't really want to fix this relationship because he knew I was crazy. And I, you know, this is a miracle. I went by myself, and I never had willingness to do anything before. And so I went to the therapist, and after a couple of sessions, he said, I think you're suffering from the disease of alcoholism. And I was like, you know, like, what? Okay, I know I like to drink, but, you know, it was just shocking. But, you know, I resisted. I resisted for a little while, and eventually he, you know, talked me into going to an Alcoholics Anonymous meeting with one of his other patients. And so I went to a meeting, and I really identified with the speaker, you know. I just heard my story, and I was, like, you know, really amazed that maybe there was a solution to the problem that I had been suffering from for 32 years. And so eventually, after a couple of days, I ended up going to an Atlantic group meeting on a Sunday night. And I remember walking to the meeting, and I was so overwhelmed because there were so many people standing outside, and everyone seemed so happy and, you know, joking around. And I was like, oh, these people are never going to accept me. So I just kept walking past the meeting, and I didn't go in. I walked all the way to the FDR, and then I stood there, and I said, I, like, struggled with myself because I knew that if I didn't go into that meeting, I knew that I was going to die because I felt myself dying. Like, I knew that I was just, like, a shell of a person, of the person that I was could be, you know? And I just needed to go in there because I needed to ask for help. And when I turned around and walked back in, the meeting had already started, and I bumped into somebody on the way, you know, as I was standing in the lobby or the waiting area, and I said, are you going to a meeting? And she said, AA? And I was like, oh, yeah, I think that's the meeting that I'm looking for. Like, somebody had sent me there, you know, and I didn't know what I was there for. And she's like, oh, come with me. And so we sat down, and she ended up becoming my sponsor. And, you know, again, I really identified. But I'll tell you, I was really overwhelmed in the beginning. You know, the idea of never drinking again was scary to me because, and I didn't know that I could do it, you know, but the one day at a time thing really helped me. And then we started going through the book and line by line, page by page. I started to work the steps, and I started to feel better. I started to understand that I had a disease, and the disease centers in my mind, and that disease wants me to die, so I can't listen to it. You know, I can't listen to my mind, so I need other people to help me, and that I need a relationship with a higher power. And so I started to pray. And, you know, for me, it wasn't like, oh, I just started to pray and the faith came right away. It was that I had a willingness to be open to it. And the faith came later for me. So if anyone's new out there and they're struggling, it's like just to have the willingness to be open to, you know, a higher power is all you need in the beginning. And then I actually left that relationship I was in because I realized I had to put my sobriety first and take care of myself. And I slept on a friend's couch for 2.5 months. And during that time, I got a new job offer, a job that was paying me a lot more than I was making. And at that time, I was worried because I didn't know how I was going to be able to support myself. So it was just another miracle in my life. And then later on, months later, that boyfriend, you know, really saw the changes that I had made. And he had made a lot of changes himself by starting to go to therapy and try to understand, you know, who I was and what I needed. And we came back together because we realized that we loved each other so much. And this past February, we got engaged and getting married in September. And, you know, I just want to say that, you know, if you're new, like, you can have this too. I'm just one of thousands of people who have made a commitment to this program and has watched their lives get better, you know, really by just taking some action. Sometimes we don't know what those actions are, you know. I call my sponsor every day. I write out my 10 step a lot, you know, and sometimes it's with the same person over and over again. And, you know, but I realize if I have a resentment that I'm blocking myself from God, and I don't want that, you know, because I don't feel good when that happens. And I have 3 service commitments at my home group, which is, you know, the Atlantic group, and I call other people. And today I just got my first sponsee, which is really such a gift. And thank you. And, you know, I just want to say thank you so much to everyone in this room, because you are like all, I feel like, my soulmates. You know, there's so much love outside of the room as well, but in here I really believe that we are like all here for each other, and I feel so safe here, and I love you all so much. So thank you for my sobriety.
Our main speaker tonight is Ron.
First for me, I've never heard had anybody adjust the microphone for me. You know, it's a great experience. I'll remember that forever. My name's Ron, and I'm an alcoholic. And you know, I look around this room now. You know, my sobriety date is way back, and I realize that 90% of the people in this room weren't born when I got sober. You know. And it's really a wonderful experience, because it shows a change in Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, it shows that people can come in here young and learn to enjoy their lives, learn to be honest with themselves. You know, and even to this day, most of the people I travel with are people that are in Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, and not that I'm a snob or anything like that, but that's the people I have things in common with. I have a business that was on the verge of bankruptcy 47 years ago when I came into the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, you know. My whole life was falling apart, and I didn't know why. Isn't it terrible that we're the last ones to know why? You know? And, I mean, everybody tried to tell me, you know. I took my first drink at 13. You know, I really don't have that much time. 30 minutes isn't a lot of time for me with the years that I've been in and the things I like to talk about and what have you, you know. But it's what I have and what I'm going to use, and I'm going to get beeped 3 times, and then, what'd you say, a duck comes out or something? And, anyway, you know, I was one of those insecure guys hanging around with a bunch of guys like me that were insecure, you know, and trying to be tough, trying to be a man, you know, and I was only 13. And I remember we used to have the cigarettes in our mouth and the cut-off T-shirts, you know, and we'd be talking out of the side of our mouths, you know. You know, and we'd be trying to flex muscles that hadn't quite arrived yet. Now, many years later, and I say this for the young people too, if you stay sober, this is what you're going to end up looking like. The hair's going to be gray if you have any at all. You know, those muscles that I tried to show at 13, you know, and the chest have all settled. They're all down around here now. You know, the nice part about being my age is that you've had, everything's happened in your life, except for one thing, I'm still here, you know. But I bought a new jacket and pants just in case I have to leave quickly. But, you know, I remember they'd come out with a bottle, 5-star half and half was the name of it. It was an expensive drink. I think it was 35 cents a pint or something like that, you know. And I remember taking some of it, and it was terrible. It was the only wine I ever had that I don't think ever saw a grape. You know what I mean? And you felt it burn, and you didn't know whether you wanted to come up or go down. And then all of a sudden, you just feel that thing that takes place in people like us. You know, that euphoria. I learned the word euphoria in AA, I want you to know. The euphoria, you know, and that wonderful feeling. And I spent the next 15 years looking for that feeling again and again and again, you know. And I think in the back of my mind, I knew I always had to pay a price for it, You know, there's a price to be paid for it. You know, we had a lot of anniversary announcements and people with 12 days and 30 days and 50 days. You know, keep one thing in mind. Place the greatest belief on your sobriety, you know. Let it be the most important thing in your life. Because if you don't, you may lose it and you may never make it back. People always ask me, Jesus, you're sober so long. Do you ever think about taking a drink? I don't really. But usually it's a newcomer that asks me that, you know. And I say to him, well, yeah, I do think about taking a drink. But then I think about coming back and you may be my sponsor. Now, if all else fails, think about that. Anyway, to go down the line, you know. But before that night was over, and this is typical of all my drinking, before that night was over, I blacked out. I passed out on the railroad tracks in Freeport. My buddies were still with me, you know. I went into the Texas Ranger restaurant and got sick. And the next day, I felt the hammers of hell going through my head because I was to experience my first of what was going to be hundreds of hangovers. Now, you got to be insane to put your body and your mind through these things and put the price you have to pay out of your mind, you know? I would give up drinking for periods of time. I was a periodic, and I'm sure a lot of people can identify with being a periodic. You know, a periodic is a person sometimes that just drinks on weekends, you know. But as you go down the line, you know, the drinks get closer and closer together. You know, when alcohol's around, I drank. And if it wasn't, needless to say, I couldn't drink. I was one of the lucky ones that was drafted. I had been in jail, too, before I was 20 years old, you know, for minor things, you know, like assaulting a cop or something like that, you know. And they didn't have DWIs in my day. You didn't go to jail for driving, but there was a law against hitting cops, you know. And I remember I never remembered. I'd wake up in jail, and I'm looking around, and I'm all beat up, you know. And then I asked the cop what happened, and he wouldn't tell me. And he looked at me like with dirty looks, you know. And I remember the next day, you know, going before a judge, and the judge read off the charges, assault. And I'm thinking to myself, thank God they got the guy, because I was always the one that was beat up, you know. And then, you know, the foxhole prayers, God, please get me out of this one, and this will never happen again. We had a thing in our day, they called it the draft, you know. At 21, I got that little card in the mail, and they said they were going to take me into the service. I said, well, I felt good about it to a degree, because I always wanted to do things right, want to be somebody, you know. And I went into the service with the intentions of being a good soldier, you know. But if you're an alcoholic, understand the control that state of mind has over our actions. And with your steps, you're learning how to see things differently. And, you know, I like what Liz always said. The miracle of AA is the fact that we stay around long enough to see the problem. Because it takes a long time sometimes. You have to listen to a lot of people, the sharing. And that's why open meetings were so important to me in those early years, you know. I went in the service, and I wanted to be a good soldier, and I was for about 3 months. And then what happened, I got a resentment. What is that, the 10th step or something like that? You know, I got a resentment. And needless to say, I didn't know how to handle resentments, really. I either fought you or I left you when I drank, and that's what I did. I went out, I picked up a drink, I ended up in Blackstone, Virginia. The MPs picked me up, and they brought me back to camp, and I was court-martialed for the first time. And I remember they asked me, you want to volunteer for a little trip to Desert Rock, Nevada? I thought it was some kind of a nice thing that I was going to. Come to find out, it was the atom bomb test I went through. That was a blast. I want to tell you, it was a blast. I also had another problem, and I like this, because when I came into the program, the first thing I heard two speakers. Now, understand, speakers weren't like us. Today. They were down-and-out drunks in many cases. The majority of sobriety was like two and a half years. There was nobody with long-term sobriety. Bill had 26 years when I got here. Liz Bailey had 9.5 years when I got here. But most everybody had young sobriety as it is today. And one of the men who was a little older, you know, I remember one thing he said. He said, I just have to remember when I take the first drink, I just can't guarantee what the outcome was going to be. To me, to this day, that's a simple explanation of alcoholism. When I took that first drink, I never knew where I was going to end up or what was going to happen. I ended up in strange places. I remember once drinking at the EEM club and just taking a few drinks and controlling it. You know, we got drunk every time. Maybe we'd learn. But there's a lot of times booze did exactly what I wanted it to do for me. And I remember I'm in the EM club and I'm taking a few drinks. I feel great. The next day I did the same thing, felt great. The next day I drank, I blacked out, and I came out of the blackout and I'm on a Navy ship and I'm in the Army. You know? That's just one incident. Those things happen time and time again. When I took the drink, it took me for places I never planned on going. You know, I went back into the blackout. Fortunately enough, the ship didn't untie. You know, and I come to in a blackout, come to out of a blackout, laying in a village in Korea, and my head is bleeding. And I'm frightened half to death, and I'm shaken because I know I could get killed there. You know, and the foxhole prayers again. I thank God for foxhole prayers. And God answered a lot of my prayers. He certainly did when I was a drunk. He answered them, you know. But what he was really saying to himself, maybe I'm going to instill a little more pain as we go along. And that's what happened. He did. I got out of the service in 1955, I guess, you know. And I here again, I wanted to be that good guy. I wanted to be successful and everything. And I remember getting into a business. I bought a landscape company. I was a gardener. That's all I was at that time. And I started to make more money than I had ever made before, you know. I went to Farmingdale Agricultural School when I wasn't drinking at night to become more knowledgeable in my field. I happen to still be in that field today, in a different phase of it. But inevitably that resentment would show up. I'd pick up that drink and I'd have to pay the piper. I got married along the way. I figured that would be the answer, you know. Let me just say this. Anybody that wants to keep drinking, don't add a wife to it. You've got enough problems already, you know. And I got married, and it was great for about 3 months. And then if you're a barroom drinker, you hear the call of the wild, you know? And I'd stop off at 3 o'clock in the afternoon, and I'd have some drinks. And all of a sudden, 3 o'clock in the morning, 3 o'clock at night becomes 3 o'clock in the morning. You have no resentment. You're in a good mood. I was in a good mood, you know. And I go home. Now there's somebody else there, my wife, you see. And she didn't understand, you know. I think I asked her if dinner was ready, you know. And she it was ready. So she threw it at me, you know. And now we started to have trouble with the police. They started to show up at the house, you know. And, you know, you don't know how often they're coming, but you know it's quite a bit if they start to call you Ron and Gloria when they know you by the first name. And usually it would be pacified, and we'd go on for a while. And this woman, she became a monster. I don't know whether I had anything to do with it, but she became a monster. She couldn't figure the next thing to do to me when I came home, when I was coming off drunks, you know. And she'd try to stop me from going out on drunks. And she'd stand in front of that car, and I had a long driveway, and Thank God she was fast in those days. One day she jumped across the hood of my car, and I've got a two blocks down, saying to myself, does she have any idea how she is embarrassing me? And I'm trying to roll her off the car, you know, hitting the brake. Now, you know, I don't think that way today, but came to believe a power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity. We travel within our own heads in a crazy environment. Those things were normal to me. Who knows what happened the next time after that or the next time after that, you know? But anyway, let's get into sobriety. I haven't got much time. I'm waiting for her to ring a bell or something. You know, I became that daily drunk. Everything started to go down the drain. I'd wake up in bed the next morning after a drunk, and I'd be shaking. You know, I'd be in a fetus position, frightened here, 15 minutes. Oh, that's not bad. And I'd be in that fetus position, shaking apart, you know, and wishing I could just get away from me, and you can't do it, you know. And you get enough of those, and I guess you want to do something about it. I know my wife met somebody. We had three kids by this time. I don't know how. I used to pass her in the dining room, and she'd tell me she was pregnant the next day. You know what I mean? I always figured I wanted to commit suicide. I was worried about killing an innocent man. You know what I mean? But, you know, thank God I didn't. And she worked with a woman whose husband was in the program. And the woman suggested that maybe I go to my wife. And my wife mentioned it to me. I said, if I ever feel I have a problem, I'll go. Only took 2 weeks, you know, 2 weeks. I had closed my garden center. I was going to go home. I was shaking, but I needed another drink to stop the shakes, you know. And I called her. I said, I'll be right home. I'm just going to have one beer. And she knew what one beer was, you know. And by the end of that day, I had been in a motorcycle race. I had been kicked out of three bars in Rockville Center, another town near me. And I came out of a blackout looking in that bar room mirror again with blood coming down my face. I had a hell of a time with overreactors. I really did. Just about the time I'm going to explain, it's too late. They've already hit me. But anyway, I went home and I told my wife, you better call this Alcoholics Anonymous, and if this doesn't work, you better take the kids and leave because I can't do it by myself. I just don't know. And AA was much different in those days, you know. We figured I'd have to go into the city or something. Who figures there's AA meetings in Nassau County? But there was. And they told me where it was. And 3 days later, I made my first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, almost saying to myself, because I was 3 days off it, maybe I don't need it. Maybe I can do it by myself, you know? And, you know, my wife said something like that. And that little voice in my ear says, hey, you've been telling yourself that for years. Go see what they have to offer. And I made my first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, frightened. I went to a group called the Freeport Group, one of the greatest groups, as far as I'm concerned, I've ever been in. There was probably 20 people in it, 15 or 20 people, all of them active. In those days, we had a thing called 12-step work where you were going out, you were going into the people's houses because the wife would call. Was that a beep? Oh, okay. I thought I turned my phone off. Anyway, that's what took place. I went into that first meeting. I heard a speaker speak, and the one thing he said, as I said before, when he took that first drink, he couldn't guarantee the outcome. And the other thing was, we don't give up drinking forever. We give it up one day at a time. You know, now those are simple things. But a lot of things you hear in Alcoholics Anonymous are simple things. And what you got to do is hang on. My sponsor used to say, you know, you're going to hear a lot of things. You're going to read a lot of things. He says, if you can hold on to a half or a quarter of what you hear and you can apply it to your life, it becomes a habit, you know. And that's it. AA, the things that I learned, the positive things I learned, became habits in my life. They got me very active in the program right from the beginning. Another fellow named Mike Minnelli and myself,
washed to China. We didn't have cups in those days, paper cups. You know, we had one big pot that a big strainer was in, and we used to take the coffee and pour it in three times, and the coffee was ready. If we ran out of coffee, we just hit it a few more times, you know. But, and I swept the floors in the Freeport Group for 2 years. And when the new guy took over, I followed him. And I followed him. I knew he wasn't going to do as good as I did. You know, it may have something to do with the alcoholic ego. I don't know. But anyway, one of the first speakers I heard, and I've done all the 12-step work. I was there when Freeport Hospital opened, and we had to go through picket lines in order to get into the hospital because the neighborhood was worried that our drunks were going to attack their women and what have you. They're worried about their children. I don't know. We never had any trouble because most of the alcoholics couldn't raise their head, let alone anything else, by the time we got them into Alcoholics Anonymous, you know. And it became one of the finest hospitals I know of. I mean, they helped thousands and thousands of people over the years. They used to call on us. They used to call us in the middle of the night because one nurse would be on and they'd be losing control of the patient. And we'd have to run in there and hold the patient down and turn him over and stick a wallet or something in his mouth so he wouldn't swallow his tongue through convulsions. You know, these, and the convulsions were common things in groups. You could be in a group and a guy could be sober 5 or 6 days and he'd roll off the chair and go into a convulsion and start to shake, you know. And, you know, you knew how to handle it. Like you know about your steps and your traditions and everything today. We knew when an alcoholic went to convulsion, stick your wallet in his mouth. Anyway, that's the way it was. And in those days, remember, we didn't have rehabs and detoxes. There was only one step meeting on all of Long Island. My sponsor had started at the Roosevelt Participation Group. It was an open-end meeting. You could stay there from 9 o'clock till 12 o'clock if you wanted. And that's what I did. I stayed there and I listened because I didn't have anything to say. I didn't know anything. And as time went on, you know, I started to become more involved in the steps and what have you. And, you know, things started to happen. I became chairman of the institutional committee from Manhattan Intergroup, and I worked out of Freeport Hospital and started meetings there. And then we moved around the rest of the eastern area, and we started meetings in many of the hospitals and institutions that people go in today were started by alcoholics. You know, we do most of it. Doctors got interested in us when it became financially profitable for them. Then they got involved in it, okay? I don't know why they didn't want to have anything to do with us. They insinuated we lied. No. Any of you people ever lie? I just told it the way I saw it, you know? But anyway, time went on. I was fortunate enough to hear Bill. I was about 2 months sober, I guess, when Bill's anniversary came up and they took me into the city and I heard Bill share. And over the next number of years, being on Manhattan Intergroup, with Manhattan Intergroup on the steering committee, and going up there, up the stepping stones many times, Bill and Lois were up there. And as years passed, I had different positions in life, you know, in AA. And in 1971, when Bill died, they asked me if I would be an usher at St. John's of Divine, February 14th, I think it was, you know. And, needless to say, I'd love to be. And I couldn't help. There must have been 5,000-6,000 people there. You know, the eulogy was given by a man named Jeff Gardner, who started AA on Long Island. Okay, and the second woman that spoke was Marty Mann. Many of you have heard about Manny Mann. She was the first lady to stay in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I couldn't help but think, how does a drunk, you know, somebody that's really nobody, how does he get from where I was to where I am, to people would hold trust in me, to where I could believe in myself, you know? And when I walked out of that church You know, I carried that feeling with me for a period of time. But, you know, feelings don't last. Feelings are something you have to keep applying to your life. And we do that by taking positive actions in AA. I've 12-stepped many, many people over the years. Not the 12 steps of just talking to somebody that walks through that room, but the 12 steps of people we had to pull out of whatever. I've pulled them out of ovens. I've pulled them out of everything. You know? And I thank God so much that he made me a part of it, you know, and that I could be there. I thank him, too, for bringing me here with you. Because as I say, I look around and I see the fruits. I see the results of the effort that was put into Alcoholics Anonymous before many of you were born. Many of the things we have today were prepared for you. I happen to have come in young. So needless to say, most of the people have passed on that we knew. But here's your legacy. It's here. It's down in Florida when I'm in AA down there. It's wherever I happen to be. I meet just wonderful people, and they treat me so well. That's because I'm old. You know? I walk with a little bit of a limp just to get a little more sympathy. You know? Okay. We got 5 minutes. What am I going to do now? You know, I like to talk about a little bit of the history of Alcoholics Anonymous, because you know what? I'm really just a member of our AA that loves this program, that's been spiritually given that wonderful feeling of positiveness when I walk into a room, when I see things take place, when I realize a miracle, the true miracle of Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, and the love we have for each other. I mean, okay, in the first year or so, you get a little angry at things. But after a while, you know, there's so much pleasure. You know, there was a few guys I wanted to kill in AA, you know. But most of them became my good friends. I 12-stepped a man named Sal. I was fighting with my wife. We were going to get a divorce. Her lawyer gave this guy my card. Because he said, this guy is a member of, is an alcoholic, me. And he says, if you ever need help, call him. And the guy did call me. And I went and got him out of a bar. I didn't have anybody with me. I was alone. He walked out with me. He's got 41 years sobriety now. See, you don't know. Mike Minnelli, the fellow I told you I washed dishes with, he lives down in Florida near me. He's got 47 years, too. You know, so miracles take place. There's guys I went out and 12-stepped, and I bring these two up. One we had to take a gun away from, you know. But Al Miller, they called me to his house. His wife made me think he was a killer. I had a cop with me. I said, you got your gun? Just in case, you know. And we went over there, and we talked to him. The guy had a big smile on his face. I found out he had a bottle hidden under the couch. But, you know, he walked out of that room with me. He walked out of that the house with me and insisted that he go into Freeport Hospital. I take him over there, and we're trying to get him in, but this guy's half drunk still, and still laughing and smiling. And the cop I brought with me, he was one of the hard guys, you know what I mean? They wanted to put him in the hospital, the cop in the hospital. But, you know, 38 years later, and I only bring this up, you don't go out for this, but this is what happens. I went to Al's funeral, and his wife loved me. She was always good to me, and she gave me a card, and she said thank you for the last 38 years. And the same thing with his friend that we took a gun away from. We did the same thing with him, and he finally got sober, and he had 28 years when he passed on. You see, life is to be lived. And we have the power to reach out and help others. Remember that power. Use it. You got it in your hands. Don't walk away from alcoholics. Take them. Give them your time. And I love this group. I think you do a wonderful job here, you know. And I hope I see you all again. We're at Jones Beach, by the way, West End 2. And we also have a breakfast where we have about 750 people every year in our, what is it, November, the first week of November. Second week of November? Change? Okay. Ask him. Anyway, God bless you all and thank you.